We're going to learn a Sikha of the Rebbe, parts at least, of a talk of the Rebbe, that the truth is, it's not talking about non-Jews, B'nai Noyach, as the subject of B'nai Noyach and their laws and their and so on. It's not talking about that, not at all. But humbly, I think it's very, very applicable, very, very current, so to speak. And we can use this to understand a little bit better the mission for B'nai Noyach, what's expected of them. So, the text, I suppose you learned, so I'm not going to go through the whole text again, that's not the point of the class. The point of the class is to bring out certain points out of the text. I'm not going to go through all the questions and all the answers and back and forth, that's not the subject of the class. The idea, the objective of the class is to extract a very specific thing. What can a non-Jew learn out of this idea that the Rebbe is going to share with us? So let's go. First of all, the basic ideas that the whole talk is based on. There's a text in the Torah. Here's the source, so to speak. This is just a translation of some of the parts. The text talks about Yisroi and Moshe. This is actually a talk. This was given, let me see, just a second. This was actually delivered in 1965. Parshas Yisroi, that this is the subject we're learning, even though this is not subjective just to a parsha or so on, but whatever, it's been said, it has been said in Parshas Yisroi. So the text talks about that Yisroi, he was not a Jew. We will see how the Torah talks about him. He was not a Jew. And he came, he was the father-in-law of Moshe Rabbeinu. The truth is, Moshe Rabbeinu was also not a Jew. He was a son or the grandson and so on of the family of Israel, whatever that means, Yaakov. His name was changed to Israel. So he was a part of the family, so to speak. But Judaism, technically speaking, starts with the giving of the Torah, which we're not going to learn today about the whole giving of the Torah. But some ideas, yes, but not the essence of the thing. But again, Yisro was not a Jew, Moshe was not a Jew, Yisro did not even form, he wasn't even part of the family, so to speak. He just became part of the family because his daughter got married to Moshe Rabbeinu. Okay, Tzipora. Very good. So Yisro came up to the desert where Moshe was over there with the Jews before the giving of the Torah. And why did he come? Because he heard that God made so many miracles and wonders for the Jews in Egypt, outside of Egypt, and so on. And therefore, he came to say, blessed be God. Look at verse number 10 over there. Blessed be God, Israel said, who delivered you, the Jewish people, from the Egyptians and Pharaoh, and who delivered the people from under the hand of the Egyptians. Oh, now I know these two verses are very important for what we're going to learn. Now I know that God is greater than all gods. See that this is not in a capital God. This is talking about other gods, pagan gods and so on. So now I know that the true one, so to speak, the true God is greater than every other gods. Yes, by the result of their very schemes against the people that the Egyptians wanted to do something to the Jews, and they ended up suffering whatever they wanted to do to the Jews. Okay, so now Israel says, now I know. I see these wonders, I saw, I heard, now I know. God is the greatest. This is what Israel said. And then the Torah continues, that we're not going to learn inside, with the giving of the Torah. Israel, first of all, tells Moshe Rabbeinu to put judges all around the place, it's going to be better like that. Okay, very nice. And then the Torah is given. This is the basics that we need to know about the Torah for in order to understand what we're going to teach. Now, let's see another text. This text comes from the Zohar. Here's the source. Zohar is a book of Kabbalah. We're not going to learn Kabbalah, don't worry. But the Zohar says something very interesting. Before Israel, again, a non-Jew, quote unquote, non-Jew. Moshe was also not a Jew, I explained this, but a non-Jew, not even part of the family. Before he acknowledged that God is the greatest, the Torah was not given to the Jewish people. Only after he recognized God, then God said, I'm going to give the Torah to my children, or whatever that means. So let's learn the Zohar. Subsequently, his priest also, he was a priest of Midian, as we're going to see in a minute only, namely Isroi, the priest of Oin, Koyen Oin, that's what it's called in the Torah. Oin was a type of idolatry. We can argue what kind of idolatry, from Egypt, not from Egypt, from Midian, I don't really care. The point is that Isroi was a priest to idolatry. We will see more details later. He was humbled. He was also humbled, so that he, humbled means like crushed, not in a good sense. Humbled like you're nothing, that kind of humbleness we're talking about. So that he came and acknowledged the Holy One, saying, this is the text of the Zohar, blessed be God who delivered you, the text we just learned. Now I know that God is greater than all gods. So when that king and that priest, that king means Pharaoh, and the priest, that means Isroi, acknowledged the Holy One, blessed be he, and were humbled before him. King actually is not Pharaoh, actually also Isroi, but whatever. When he acknowledged that God is the boss, so to speak, and he was humbled, they were humbled, he was exalted, God was exalted above and below, and then only did he give forth the Torah to the Jewish people as undisputed sovereign overall, and so on. So the Zohar says something very interesting. Again, before Israel acknowledging that God is the master and the boss and everything, the Torah was not given. And this is what the Zohar says. The Rebbe asks a very simple question. Why wasn't it enough for Moshe Rabbeinu, with Moshe Rabbeinu, Aaron HaKohen, 600,000, the word tzaddikim between them, very righteous and high level people, why wasn't that enough to give the Torah? Why, and I'm going to say this on purpose like this, so no offense, why a non-Jew had to come and say, yeah, God is great, oh yeah, now I can give the Torah? Why? We have a whole family, very holy people, why wasn't that enough? That's the question that the Rebbe asked. Now, let's see who was Israel actually. What kind of guy was he? The Torah says clearly, Koyen Midian, again in Parshas Yisro, Koyen Midian, he was a priest of Midian. Midian is a place in the south, whatever. Koyen of Midian. There are two ways to understand Koyen Midian. What does that mean? One way of understanding the word Koyen, that usually people translate priest. But there's another type of translation of Koyen. And we see this in many places. Even David HaMelech and his children are called Koyanim. What do you mean Koyen? David was from the tribe of Yehuda. They're not Koyanim. Koyen means a minister, a very high-level person in a country, a person from the Congress or whatever. He's called a Koyen in Torah. It's not a problem. It appears, again, many times. That's one translation. According to that translation, okay, so Israel was an important person in Midian, an important guy. But then the usual translation is priest. Koyen is priest. In Midian, of course, they were not, of course, Jewish, there was not such a thing as Jewish, but they were not monotheism or whatever. They were idolaters. They were pagans. And if Israel was Koyen Midian, a priest of Midian, he was a priest of idolatry. Priest of idolatry. To the point that our sages do say in the Midrash something very interesting about Israel. He wasn't just a Koyen Midian. Okay, another. Idolater, another whatever, priest of any kind of idolatry. No. It was much more than that. Israel knew and circulated among all the houses of idol worship in the whole world. He knew it all. You name it, what kind of idolatry you're talking about, he knew about it. And he just didn't, it's not just he knew about it, he served it. And he understood what the type of idolatry is, what benefits or not benefits it has, the laws of that idolatry, the way of service, and he did it. And he understood them, each one of them. That's Koyen Midian. That's who Israel actually was. And then he came to the desert to Moshe Rabbeinu to convert. Again, we learned, now I know that God is greater. Let's go back just a second. And it's going to have much more sense. Now I know that God is greater than all other gods. Yeah, really, all gods. This is literal. He understood every single type of idolatry around the world. He knew it. And he recognized, very nice, that God is the greatest one. Very nice. But the point is, he came to convert. He came to say, now I know, after knowing everything else, now I can acknowledge that this is the greatest one. And in order to answer, going back, the first question, why wasn't enough for, with Moshe Rabbeinu, Aaron, and all the Jewish, whatever, family, to give the Torah? Yisrael had to come and acknowledge God. We pose another question, and we're going to answer both of them, don't worry. Why does the Torah talk so bad about Israel? Like, the Torah is very careful with the language, and it doesn't even want to talk bad about an animal, to say that it is impure, not even that. But with Israel, we call it Kohen Midian. According to the first explanation, Kohen Midian is a minister, okay, it's an important person, that's okay. You can call the Israel Kohen Midian. But according to the second explanation, what do you mean? He's a priest of idolatry and all idolatries around the world. He knew them all. Don't call him like that. Why do you? And we're talking about the father-in-law of Moshe Rabbeinu, the father of the wife of Moshe Rabbeinu. It's not so nice to say, yeah, this guy, it's a pagan idolater and he's so smart. He knows them all. It doesn't sound so nice. So why is the Torah talking so bad about Israel? That's the second question we have, so to speak, in line. So let's try to understand. In order to understand all of this, we have to first know how idolatry actually works. How did it all start? And Rambam, Maimonides, when he starts his laws of idolatry, he explains this in a quite clear way. I'm just really compressing this and making it very short. People made a mistake. And the mistake they made wasn't a mistake out of stupidity. Like, you don't understand anything, so therefore you make idolatry, you do idolatry. No, no, no. They were very smart. And they knew, really, what was going on in the heavens and in the relationship between God and the world. They knew it all. They knew perfectly that they are intermediaries. What does that mean? God is spiritual. It's abstract. We don't understand him. And the world is a material world, physical world. When you want to eat, you need food, like physical food. Don't come to me with spiritual food. I'm hungry. I need food. Physical one. When you need to pay the bills, yeah, spiritual dollars in the world of, I don't care. Just give me the money and I'll pay the bills. Real physical money. So how do you come from a very spiritual and abstract thing, God, to a very material, real, so to speak, world that we live in? So you need something in the middle to transform, to convert a very abstract and spiritual thing into a very materialistic thing. What is this thing in the middle? That's called angels. That's called constellations, stars, sun, moon. That doesn't mean that the sun itself, like a big ball of helium or fire or whatever it is, it's doing something. Now, there's an angel behind that, making the sun actually work the way it works. And that angel is part of a system of materializing a spiritual thing. It's a very long and complex system of infinite number of angels. But the point is that there is a system. There is a system. Between parentheses, it's not the subject of today's class, but I think it's interesting to mention, our sages say that the angels are called intestines. You know, the inner parts of the stomach and all of that. And of course, any person that knows and understands a little bit, at least, you don't have to be a doctor for this, to understand how the body works. You know, you eat food, and it gets digested, and something else comes out. You know, the things you don't want, things the body doesn't need, just come out. Okay, so these levels of angels, again, we're talking about thousands and thousands and maybe infinite levels of angels. One angel digests godly, quote-unquote, food, energy, and the coming out of that angel is the food of the next angel. And then coming out of the next angel is the food of the next angel. And it goes down like a chain, like a standing chain. one level after one level after one level and so on, until it comes to us. And you know what? You know what? This is what our sages say. The pleasures, material pleasures of this world, are really the excrement of the angels. The worst of the worst, that they say, get out of here. We don't need this. What comes out of the body and so on after eating, that's what we receive over here and say, oh, what a pleasurable thing. Whatever pleasure you think it is or you feel it is, it doesn't really matter. That's what it is. Excrement of angels. Shumarei ha'oifanim. This is the way it's actually expressed in the Talmud. Okay, so closing parentheses. That's not the subject for today. It's just a perspective of what's really the pleasures of the world. What are they? Okay, coming back to this that we're trying to understand, how idolatry actually started. Idolatry started by people who understood, you can read the text by yourself, I'm not going to read it, but people understood perfectly this whole system that I just described a little bit of it. They understood of it, everything. They understood the angels, they understood each part of it, what the sun is, how it works, what the moon is, and how it works with constellations and so on. They got it all. And they saw God, they understood something of God on top of all this system, and they said, because God gave honor and greatness to these creatures, the angels, and again, the sun, the moon, and the stars, and so on, it is appropriate for us to give honor to these creatures also, because God gave honor to them. And furthermore, it is the will of God. He's happy. God is happy when we give honor to these creatures, because just as a king of flesh and blood, when somebody honors the ministers of the king who actually represent the king is also happy. Because after all, they're honoring the king also. They're not honoring the ministers because they are great people, not because they are the ministers of the king. And therefore, honor for the ministers is honor for the king. That's what they thought. And then, as time went on, this is what the Rambam explains at the beginning of his laws of idolatry, they forgot about God. The first stage is they knew about God, they understood, but, you know, ministers are also over there, and you have to give them honor. But then, in a later stage, they forgot about God, and they just started serving the ministers. Not because they were the ministers of the angels of, no. Just because they are God, so to speak. And those are all the gods that even Israel understood and served. Now, coming back to Israel. Again, he understood, he was one of those guys that served so many different types of idolatry. Why? Because he was a fool? No, he wasn't a fool. On the contrary, the other way around, on the other extreme, he was so smart, so intelligent, such a deep wisdom that he understood every single intermediary between God and the world, each one of them. And he knew exactly how to tap, so to speak, to them, how to touch them, how to serve them, how to talk to them, how to extract benefit from them, and so on. He knew it all, each one of them. In the words of Hasidus, Kabbalah, whatever, he understood the Seder Ishtalshelus. What does it mean, Seder Ishtalshelus? Shalsheles in Hebrew means a chain. So as I explained before, there is actually a chain of levels, one level after another level, that the purpose of this chain is to produce a world, a material world that we can live on, and we can bring down godliness into this world. Okay, that's very nice. That's the purpose of creation, and we're going to talk about it later a little bit. But this Seder Ishtalshelus, this whole order of a chain, Israel knew each one of the single levels over there. If a person was to, we're not going to do that, of course, but if a person was to go and learn Kisvei Arizal, the writings of the Arizal, actually Arizal didn't write anything, his students wrote for him, he goes into such a very long, detailed expression of all these levels, and he talks about each one of them, and the connections between each one of them. Okay, so Israel understood all of this. Just to put it in a humorous note, he knew Kabbalah very well. Really, very well. Even though he was not a Jew and so on, but he knew it much better than me. Definitely, He understood each single level around that. And that's what it means that Israel was Koyen Midian. We're not talking bad about Israel. That's a pagan, idolater, get out of here. No, no, no. We're saying this guy, he really knows. He really knows it all. Now, after all of that, even though he understood everything, he still said, wait a second, Torah, God is the best, is the greatest. What happened over there? What was going on within Israel himself? What was he accomplishing by, again, understanding every single type of idolatry around the world and still leaving all of that and saying, God is greater. I'm going to convert to Judaism or whatever Israel did. What did he accomplish? So in order to understand his accomplishment, we have to understand one verse in Koheleth. I think it's called Ecclesiastes or whatever that means. I don't know. Shlomo HaMelech says like this, I found that wisdom is superior to folly, as light is superior to darkness. The truth is, Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon, he was the wisest person in the face of the earth. Now, question yourself a very simple question. Do you need a wise, really, the wisest person in the world to understand that light is better than darkness? Darkness. I think it's so simple and so obvious. Yeah, a dark room, I don't see anything. Turn on the light and you'll see. You don't need to be smart for that. You don't need to be Shlomo HaMelech. So why is he saying? What is he saying over here? Wisdom is superior to folly, really? You're a very wise guy. It's better to be wise than to be stupid, of course. And it's better light than darkness, of course. What is he saying over here? He's saying something much, much deeper than just what it seems to be saying. What he's saying is, one thing is light and wisdom. Same thing, light and wisdom, they go hand by hand. And also folly and darkness. It's the same. Let's call them the same thing, whatever. For our purpose, it's the same thing. One thing is light, one thing is wisdom. And that's very good, and that's very nice. But you know what? When wisdom comes from folly, when light comes from darkness, that's much better. Definitely. Simple example of this. Very simple example. There's an expression in Judaism, Ein chacham kebala nisayin. There's no wise person than, no wiser person than, no wiser guy than somebody that actually tried and tested. He had a challenge and he passed the challenge. He is wisest than a person that just has the tools to pass the challenge, but he didn't actually face the challenge yet. Suppose a doctor. So the guy understood, he went to the university, he learned, he has good notes, good grades and everything, but he never touched a sick person at all. Never saw a sick person. He knows all the books. He's really, his mind is bright, bright mind. He learned all the books. He read everything. He's the wisest student in the whole university, but he never touched a sick person. Never saw a sick person, just the books, books and books. Would you go treat yourself with this such a doctor? I wouldn't go. Not at all. But he knows all the books, yeah. But he doesn't know what a person actually is, how to treat a sick person. He doesn't know. On the other hand, not such a wise doctor, but he went through the university and he finished and he did all the things that he had to do. And he already has experience seeing sick people. But he's not the wisest doctor in the world, but he has already experience. I would go to that doctor. Why? Because all the books will not teach you what experience can actually teach you. Not at all. And this is what it means. This is like this one explanation of what it means. The light that comes from darkness, the wisdom that comes from folly, from trying, from being there, from actually being in front of the challenge. There's another idea, a little bit deeper, a little bit more complex, and this is actually what the Rebbe is talking about, even though the Rebbe doesn't mention this idea in the talk. But the idea is like this. How do you actually, this is brought down in the books, I know it's going to sound strange, but whatever. How do you actually remember a law in Torah? You learn halacha, you learn laws, for Jews, for non-Jews, who cares? Whatever, you learn law. But you're not going to remember the law, that's what it's written. You're not going to remember the law until you stumble with the law. What does it mean you stumble with the law? You make a mistake. When you make a mistake and somebody asks you, Rabbi, what's the law in such and such case? And you, whatever, said, this is the law. And then you found out you said wrong. It's wrong. You pick up the book and you look, oh, I said wrong. And you call the guy, yeah, I'm sorry, I made a mistake. Yeah, but sometimes no way to fix it. That's it. The guy already did whatever he did, or that's it. Nothing to fix over here. Okay, I'm sorry, I made a mistake. That law, you'll never forget. Believe me, you'll never forget. Next time somebody asks you, Rabbi, what's the law in that such a case? You'll say, I checked the book. The law is this. I'm sure about it. How are you so sure? Because I already made a mistake on this one. I'll never forget that. Okay, so that's what the Rebbe actually is talking about over here. When wisdom comes from folly, when light comes from darkness, that means you transform the darkness into light. That's a much powerful light than just light, than just learning all the books, the doctor learns all the books. Yeah, but this other doctor already touched some patient and the patient said, okay, I learned that hurts. I'm sorry. It wasn't my intention, but whatever. I'm sorry, I'm not touching anymore. It's okay. You learned already. And the other one knows all the books and he's going to touch and he's going to hurt because he doesn't have the experience. He didn't make the mistake of touching where he didn't have to touch and it hurt. And this is what actually happened with Israel. He understood, again, we're talking good about Israel. He was Kohen Midian. He was the priest of Midian. He knew every single idolatry around the world. And he still left all of that and he served God. But the truth is, he didn't quote unquote leave all of that. What I mean is, he didn't continue being an idolater, don't misunderstand me. He left idolatry, but he didn't leave the knowledge. The knowledge of all the bad things he knew, he actually took it and literally added it into holiness. He used all his previous knowledge and actually used it to serve God in his conversion or whatever he did when he did it there in the desert, in the giving of the Torah. I don't know, and I don't really care. It's not the subject for today. But Israel had this idea, this capacity of taking wisdom out of folly. Folly means the idolatry in this case of Israel. But he transformed this folly into wisdom. The darkness of idolatry, he transformed it into light. And the truth is, I should have put this in the bottom instead of up here, but the truth is, that's the whole purpose of Torah. That's what the Torah was given. Let's learn it. Before giving of the Torah, our sages say, the Midrashim bring down, our sages say that there was a separation between the heavens, spirituality, and this world, to the point that this is a famous subject, an idea regarding idolatry. The ancient idolaters, not today's, today is not so much like that, but the ancient idolaters used to say, Ozav Hashem Es Ha'aretz, God left the world. God is too holy, too high to manage and deal with our like small things, small world. So he left. And he put the stars and constellations, idolatry, in charge of the world. That's what the ancient idolaters used to say. Why? Because actually there was a time where there was a separation. Not that God left the world, Chas v'Shalom, God forbid, he never did that, and he will never do that because he promised, and so on. But there was a separation. Spirituality did not mix with materiality. And we know, and we learned in other classes also, definitely, the story of Yaakov. Yaakov Avinu, our sages bring in the Zohar, that he fulfilled mitzvahs, commandments, even though they were not given yet, by doing certain activities that have no connection to today's, so to speak, commandments after the giving of the Torah. And after fulfilling the commandments, the way he did it, he just threw away to the garbage the objects with which he actually fulfilled the commandments. Without going into the details, tefillin, it doesn't really matter right now. The point is that this world got not influenced, so to speak, imbued with kedusha, with sanctity. Why? Again, because before the giving of the Torah, there was a disconnection, complete disconnection between spirituality and materiality. When God gives the Torah, he comes down in Mount Sinai and he tells Moshe Rabbeinu to go up into Mount Sinai. That means spirituality came down from above to below, and the materiality went up from below to above, and there was a meeting, so to speak. In the words of our sages, God annulled, destroyed this separation, this disconnection, and allowed spirituality to actually be injected into the material world, to the point that today, nowadays, when we fulfill a mitzvah with a specific material object, this object becomes a holy object, because now has a kedusha, has a sanctity on it. Sometimes we see it, sometimes we don't see it, which is a different subject. But that's the whole purpose of the giving of the Torah. So let's go back a little bit, and we'll move on in a second. So what's the purpose of Torah? To actually fill a material world that seems to be disconnected from God, fill it with godliness. And this is actually what Israel did. By taking all his knowledge, he transformed, filled all his knowledge with kedusha, with sanctity. Now, having said all of this, there's still a little bit of a problem over here. We didn't finish answering all the questions. We just answered the fact that the Torah doesn't talk bad about Israel by saying that he was a priest of Midian. We're talking good about him. We're actually saying something, a praise about it. But there's still a problem. And the problem is like this. This, the giving of the Torah, was not the only moment in history, so to speak, that God annulled this disconnection between spirituality and materiality. There was another situation. What was the situation? The splitting of the Red Sea. We know, we learn in Jewish mysticism, Hasidus, Kabbalah, whatever, we learn that actually the splitting of the sea wasn't just a splitting, it was revealing something that was hidden. The sea is full of water, and the water is covering actually what's on the bottom of the sea. We don't see it. So the same thing happens with this material world. It covers on the spiritual world. We don't see it. You can open your eyes and you don't see God. We see ourselves and so on. So by the splitting of the sea, besides the whole detail of this water splitting and moving and so on, like walls, no. Let's focus on the thing that was actually hidden. The bed of the sea, so to speak, the bottom of the sea, became revealed. Spirituality became revealed in this material world. That's what actually happened in the splitting of the sea. So why isn't enough with this to actually generate the same thing as the giving of the Torah generated? In other words, why was it necessary to give the Torah if such a process of revealing that which was hidden, bringing spirituality in the material world, was already done by the splitting of the sea? Why wasn't it enough? So with this question, actually, the Rebbe answers, I'll go back in a second. The Rebbe answers this question. Why wasn't it enough with Moshe, Aaron, all the Jews, holy people, to actually give the Torah? And again, now we're standing over here. Why wasn't, same question, but in a different words, why wasn't enough with the splitting of the sea, and we needed to give the Torah and so on? Why? And the answer is very simple. Because by the splitting of the sea, something very interesting happened. On one hand, the Jewish people, the Jewish family, or whatever they want to call them, children of Israel, I don't care, they were actually going through the sea, the bed of the sea, the bottom of the sea. They were walking over there and so on. But the Egyptians were dying. There wasn't a refinement of the Egyptians. There wasn't an elevation of the Egyptians. On the contrary, they were killed. So that means that the holiness revealed in the moment of the splitting of the sea was a very interesting holiness, but it didn't permeate, so to speak. It didn't go as down as to transform the Egyptians from a bad thing into a good thing. No. The sea killed them. That's it. To the point that the angels complain actually to God, why do you kill the Egyptians and you save the Jews? They're all idolaters over here. The Jews weren't so tzaddikim, so righteous people at that time. But the point is that the Egyptians were completely destroyed by the splitting of the sea. In our context means, again, that the holiness getting revealed at that particular time did not change the Egyptians. No. But by the giving of the Torah, yes. The giving of the Torah accomplished something much more deeper, much, much deeper. What's the, again, the purpose of the giving of the Torah? To refine and elevate even the lowest of the lowest, even Israel, who understood and knew and served every single idolatry available in the world at that time, or whatever the world was at that time, he was able to get refined and elevated together with all his knowledge into holiness, which that is actually the whole purpose of the giving of the Torah. It's not that it should remain in a holy place. Let me say this in a different way. At least what I'm going to say is what the Rebbe taught us. There are other perspectives. Yes, definitely. So whatever, if you have a question, you have to ask them, not me. The Rebbe taught us like this. The purpose of Torah is not to remain in Mea Shearim, you know, a very interesting neighborhood in Yerushalayim, in Bnei Brak, over there, and be a Jew, and I don't care about the world. Let them all die. Jews, non-Jews, the non-religious Jews, the non-Jews, who cares? I don't care. I live in my 4x4 house, whatever. I live in my place, my walls, and I'm happy over here, Torah and godliness and prayer and everything like that. I don't need to affect the world. I don't need to change anything anywhere. Maybe within myself, yeah, I have to refine myself, very nice. But the rest of the world, who cares? The Rebbe taught us different. That's not the purpose of Torah. No. Purpose of Torah is that it should permeate and fill every single corner of the world. That every single corner of the world should understand that there's a God, that there is holiness. It's an interesting story, it's a very deep story, but I'll say it as simple as I can. Interesting story by the Alter Rebbe and his son, who was actually later the Mittel Rebbe, the second Rebbe of Chabad. The Alter Rebbe founded Chabad movement, and then the Mittel Rebbe. The Alter Rebbe was called Shneur Zalman, the Mittel Rebbe was called Doiber. Now, the story is that after Rosh Hashanah, after the beginning of the Jewish year, which is a very deep holiday and very interesting holiday, the Mittel Rebbe went to the Alter Rebbe, and he told him, I don't remember all the details of the story, but he told him, I was praying this Rosh Hashanah with a specific idea. The idea that the unity of God and something like that, something very deep, you can imagine the Rebbe was thinking about throughout Rosh Hashanah. Very good. And the son asked the father, where were you praying with? And the Alter Rebbe answered, I was praying with my shtender. Shtender is the piece of wood that you use to put your book. You know, standing and you put the book and you can read the book without having to hold it in your hands. I was praying with my shtender. That's what the Alter Rebbe said. That's the story. So we need to understand this story a little bit better. Wait a second. Is it a joke? Like the son came to the father, I'm praying with a very deep understanding of godliness and you're praying with a piece of wood? What are you talking about? What were you thinking about? My question is, not where you were you putting your book. What was holding your book? What were you thinking about? And the idea behind the story is the mind, so to speak, of the Alter Rebbe was so deep that he was explaining, just as it sounds, he was explaining to a piece of wood that there's a God. We say in the prayers of Rosh Hashanah, Yeder kol po'ul ketafe altoi. The translation would be something like any creature should know that you created, you God created them. Everything should know. And not just like human beings, okay, creatures, human beings, who can understand? A dog can understand. Dogs don't understand anything. A human being, no. The Alter Rebbe was talking to a wood, a piece of wood. You should also understand and recognize that God created you. That was the deepness of the thinking of the Alter Rebbe in Rosh Hashanah. Taking that story and applying it to what we're learning today, even the lowest of the lowest of the whole creation, even the most pagan and idolater guy in the whole world, Israel, he should also recognize that there's a God. And only then God said, I'm ready to give the Torah now. Because somebody understood this whole idea. Somebody understands what I'm planning over here by recognizing me. Now I can give the Torah. Just by the splitting of the sea, and our sages do say that even a most simple person saw by the splitting of the sea what the greatest prophets of the Jewish people never saw. But they saw it, the holiness, the godliness, whatever they saw, I don't know. But they saw it by the splitting of the sea. That's not enough. That's not enough, because that's only in the realm of holiness. At least it was from the family of Jewish people, of the children of Israel, at least came out and converted, whatever that means, that Moshe Rabbeinu decided to convert so many people by going out of Egypt. Whatever that means, that's already Kedusha. That's only, quote unquote, Kedusha, holiness, sanctity. That holiness recognizes, says God, me? What's the novelty over there? That's not Torah. That's not the purpose of Torah. But when Israel, that he was a Kohen Midian, a priest of Midian, that sounds like a bad thing, but actually is a good thing. He knew so much. He understood so much. He recognizes me. I mean, so much of idolatry. He recognizes me. He got the point of the Torah. Now I can give the Torah to the Jewish people. Now, that's the talk of the Rebbe. There are more details over there. I hope you read the text, or you can read the text now, whatever. Now, this over here is not in the talk of the Rebbe, definitely not. So this doesn't mean that these are the only ideas you could actually learn from this talk. This is what occurred to me, okay, in my mind. Let's read them. How can you apply this to a Ben Noach, to a non-Jew that wants to follow the path of Judaism according to the message of Judaism for non-Jews and so on? By the non-Jews recognizing the true God, it shows how the Torah actually permitted even the lowest situations. Because most of non-Jews, most of Bnei Noach, not all of them, but most of them, come from a different religion, let's call it like that. Whatever that religion was, they come from something. Some people are atheists and then they become whatever, Bnei Noach. No. But most of the people, they had a religion. And that religion, not always is so good, quote unquote. But by them recognizing that there is a God, they actually get elevated. They get definitely elevated. And that doesn't mean that they have to completely forget about their experiences. It is their experiences that brought them to this point. If it wouldn't have been for those experiences, like, don't regret. Of course, regret the things that you did wrong. Okay, you have to do tshuva and God is going to forgive, don't worry. He's good. He wants us to be alive and so on. But don't forget everything. Why not? Because those situations, those experiences brought you to Judaism, to the true God, so to speak. And that shows that even in the lowest place, there's godliness also over there. You have the power, so to speak, the capacity of connected to godliness over there. By sharing this knowledge, who you were, in which situation you were, and so on, that can help other people also. That can help somebody else. And that adds, this is the words of the Rebbe, literally by Israel, that adds into holiness. You take something that is not holy, is idolatry, paganism or whatever it is, you can actually transform it into holiness. How does it work? Okay, I don't know. have to recognize it. I don't know. But this is what the Rebbe says. Definitely. Maybe one possible explanation is, I always give the same example because it's so easy and so simple. A person that lives in a city that has a sea. You know, you can go to the shore and see the sea and watch the, whatever, go to the beach and so on. You're not desperate to go to the beach because you see it every day. But a person that lives, you know, in our modern cities, it's just cement and more bricks and so on, and you're desperate to go to the sea. You want to see the sea, it's nice, it's beautiful. The same thing happens, exactly the same thing happens with enthusiasm that a non-Jew, and this also applies to Jews, that a non-Jew can have by leaving idolatry and discovering godliness, discovering Judaism for non-Jews and so on. The enthusiasm with which they live is much greater than the enthusiasm that many religious Jews have even today. Definitely. And again, there's no need to abandon what you were before, what the knowledge you had before. On the contrary, use your knowledge to serve God. Use your knowledge to serve God. A very simple example, I see it in myself. I worked in computers, I worked in electronics, whatever. So I used that knowledge in order to apply it to serving God. Definitely. So this is something we can learn out of Israel. Definitely. Now, of course, each one of us is not Israel. Each one of us learns lessons out of Israel. And the fact, and the Rebbe mentioned this so many times, the fact that we hear that there's such a lesson that we can learn from such a person, that itself gives us the proof that up to a certain point, that lesson definitely applies to us also, to not to abandon who we are, who we were, and so on, but to use that and transform it from folly into wisdom, from darkness into holiness.